Chapter 7. Utterly vain. Besides, being very young, he had found the occupation of keeping his heart completely steeled against the worst, so engrossing that he had come to feel an overpowering dislike towards any other form of activity whatever. He was not scared. He knew this because, firmly believing he would never see another sunrise, he remained calm in that belief. These are the moments of do-nothing heroics to which even good men surrender at times. Many officers of ships can no doubt recall a case in their experience, when just such a trance of confounded stoicism would come all at once over a whole ship's company. Jukes, however, had no wide experience of men or storms. He conceived himself to be calm, inexorably calm, but as a matter of fact he was daunted. Not abjectly, but only so far as a decent man may, without becoming loathsome to himself. It was rather like a forced on numbness of spirit. The long, long stress of a gale does it, the suspense of the interminably culminating catastrophe, and there is a bodily fatigue in the mere holding on to existence within the excessive tumult, a searching and insidious fatigue that penetrates deep into a man's breast, to cast down and sadden his heart, which is incorrigible, and of all the gifts of the earth even before life itself aspires to peace. Jukes was benumbed much more than he supposed. He held on very wet, very cold, stiff in every limb, and in a momentary hallucination of swift visions, it is said, that a drowning man thus reviews all his life, he beheld all sorts of memories altogether unconnected with his present situation. He remembered his father, for instance, a worthy businessman, who at an unfortunate crisis in his affairs went quietly to bed, and died forthwith in a state of resignation. Jukes did not recall these circumstances, of course, but remaining otherwise unconcerned he seemed to see distinctly the poor man's face. A certain game of nap played, when quite a boy in Table Bay on board a ship, since lost with all hands. The thick eyebrows of his first skipper, and without any emotion, as he might years ago have walked listlessly into her room, and found her sitting there with a book, he remembered his mother dead too, now the resolute woman, left badly off, who had been very firm in his bringing up. It could not have lasted more than a second, perhaps not so much. A heavy arm had fallen about his shoulders. Captain McWhirr's voice was speaking his name into his ear. Jukes. Jukes. He detected the tone of deep concern. The wind had thrown its weight on the ship, trying to pin her down amongst the seas. They made a clean breach over her, as over a deep swimming log, and the gathered weight of crashes menaced monstrously from afar. The breakers flung out of the night with a ghostly light on their crests, the light of sea foam that in a ferocious, boiling up pale flash showed upon the slender body of the ship the toppling rush, the downfall, and the seething mad scurry of each wave. Never for a moment could she shake herself clear of the water. Jukes, rigid, perceived in her motion the ominous sign of haphazard floundering. She was no longer struggling intelligently. It was the beginning of the end. And the note of busy concern in Captain McWhirr's voice sickened him like an exhibition of blind and pernicious folly. The spell of the storm had fallen upon Jukes. He was penetrated by it, absorbed by it. He was rooted in it with a rigor of dumb attention. Captain McWhirr persisted in his cries, but the wind got between them like a solid wedge. He hung round Jukes' neck as heavy as a millstone, and suddenly the sides of their heads knocked together. Jukes. Mr. Jukes, I say. He had to answer that voice, that would not be silenced. He answered in the customary manner. Yes, sir. And directly, his heart, corrupted by the storm that breeds a craving for peace, rebelled against the tyranny of training and command. Captain McWhirr had his mate's head fixed firm in the crook of his elbow, and pressed it to his yelling lips mysteriously. Sometimes Jukes would break in, admonishing hastily, "Look out, sir," or Captain McWhirr would bawl an earnest exhortation to hold hard, there, and the whole black universe seemed to reel together with the ship. They paused. She floated yet. And Captain McWhirr would are some his shouts. Dot 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 says dot 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 whole lot. Dot dot fetched away. Dot 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 ought to see dot 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 what's the matter. Directly the full force of the hurricane had struck the ship, every part of her deck became untenable, and the sailors, dazed and dismayed, took shelter in the port alleyway under the bridge. It had a door aft, which they shut. It was very black, cold, and dismal. At each heavy fling of the ship they would groan all together in the dark, and tons of water could be heard scuttling about, as if trying to get at them from above. The boatswain had been keeping up a gruff talk, but a more unreasonable lot of men, he said afterwards, he had never been with. They were snug enough there, out of harm's way, and not wanted to do anything either. And yet they did nothing but grumble, and complain peevishly like so many sick kids. Finally, one of them said that, if there had been at least some light, to see each other's noses by, it wouldn't be so bad. It was making him crazy, he declared, to lie there in the dark waiting for the blamed hooker to sink. Why don't you step outside, then, and be done with it at once, the boatswain turned on him. This called up a shout of execration. The boatswain found himself overwhelmed with reproaches of all sorts. They seemed to take it ill that a lamp was not instantly created for them out of nothing. They would whine after a light, to get drowned by anyhow. And though the unreason of their revilings was patent, since no one could hope to reach the lamp room, which was forward, he became greatly distressed. He did not think it was decent of them to be nagging at him like this. He told them so, and was met by general contumely. He sought refuge, therefore, in an embittered silence. At the same time their grumbling and sighing and muttering worried him greatly, but by and by it occurred to him that there were 6 globe lamps hung in the tween deck, and that there could be no harm in depriving the coolies of one of them. The Nanshan had an athwartship coal bunker, which, being at times used as cargo space, communicated by an iron door with the fore tween deck. It was empty then, and its manhole was the foremost one in the alleyway. The boatswain could get in, therefore, without coming out on deck at all, but to his great surprise he found he could induce no one to help him in taking off the manhole cover. He groped for it all the same, but one of the crew lying in his way refused to budge. "Why, I only want to get you that blamed light you are crying for," he expostulated, almost pitifully. Somebody told him to go and put his head in a bag. He regretted he could not recognize the voice, and that it was too dark to see, otherwise, as he said, he would have put a head on that son of a sea cook, anyway, sink or swim. Nevertheless, he had made up his mind to show them he could get a light, if he were to die for it. Through the violence of the ship's rolling, every movement was dangerous. To be lying down seemed labor enough. He nearly broke his neck dropping into the bunker. He fell on his back, and was sent shooting helplessly from side to side in the dangerous company of a heavy iron bar, a coal trimmer slice probably left down there by somebody. This thing made him as nervous as though it had been a wild beast. He could not see it, the inside of the bunker coated with coal dust being perfectly and impenetrably black, but he heard it sliding and clattering, and striking here and there, always in the neighborhood of his head. It seemed to make an extraordinary noise, to give heavy thumps, as though it had been as big as a bridge girder. This was remarkable enough for him to notice, while he was flung from port to starboard and back again, and clawing desperately the smooth sides of the bunker in the endeavor to stop himself. The door into the tween deck not fitting quite through, he saw a thread of dim light at the bottom. Being a sailor, and a still active man, he did not want much of a chance to regain his feet, and as luck would have it, in scrambling up he put his hand on the iron slice, picking it up as he rose. Otherwise he would have been afraid of the thing breaking his legs, or at least knocking him down again. At first he stood still. He felt unsafe in this darkness that seemed to make the ship's motion unfamiliar, unforeseen, and difficult to counteract. He felt so much shaken for a moment that he dared not move for fear of aching charge again. He had no mind to get battered to pieces in that bunker. He had struck his head twice. He was dazed a little. He seemed to hear, yet so plainly, the clatter and bangs of the iron slice flying about his ears, that he tightened his grip, to prove to himself he had it there safely in his hand. He was vaguely amazed at the plainness with which down there he could hear the gale raging. Its howls and shrieks seemed to take on, in the emptiness of the bunker, something of the human character, of human rage and pain being not vast but infinitely poignant. And there were, with every roll, thumps, two profound, ponderous thumps, as if a bulky object of 5-ton weight or so had got play in the hold. But there was no such thing in the cargo. Something on deck? Impossible. Or alongside? Couldn't be. He thought all this quickly, clearly, competently, like a seaman, and in the end remained puzzled. This noise, though, came deadened from outside, together with the washing and pouring of water on deck above his head. Was it the wind? Must be. It made down there a row like the shouting of a big lot of crazed men. And he discovered, in himself, a desire for a light, to if only to get drowned by, and a nervous anxiety to get out of that bunker as quickly as possible. He pulled back the bolt. The heavy iron plate turned on its hinges, and it was as though he had opened the door to the sounds of the tempest. A gust of hoarse yelling met him. The air was still, and the rushing of water overhead was covered by a tumult of strangled, throaty shrieks that produced an effect of desperate confusion. He straddled his legs the whole width of the doorway, and stretched his neck. And at first he perceived only what he had come to seek. 6 small yellow flames swinging violently on the great body of the dusk. It was stayed like the gallery of a mine, with a row of stanchions in the middle, and crossbeams overhead, penetrating into the gloom ahead indefinitely. And to port there loomed, like the caving in of one of the sides, a bulky mass with a slanting outline. The whole place, with the shadows and the shapes, moved all the time. The boatswain glared. The ship lurched to starboard, and a great howl came from that mass, that had the slant of fallen earth. Pieces of wood whizzed past. Planks, he thought, inexpressibly startled, and flinging back his head. At his feet a man went sliding over, open-eyed, on his back, straining with uplifted arms for nothing. And another came bounding like a detached stone with his head between his legs and his hands clenched. His 58 pigtail whipped in the air, he made a grab at the boatswain's legs, and from his opened hand a bright white disc rolled against the boatswain's foot. He recognized a silver dollar, and yelled at it with astonishment. With a precipitated sound of trampling and shuffling of bare feet, and with guttural cries, the mound of writhing bodies piled up to port detached itself from the ship's side and sliding, inert and struggling, shifted to starboard, with a dull, brutal thump. The cry ceased. The boatswain heard a long moan through the roar and whistling of the wind. He saw an inextricable confusion of heads and shoulders, naked soles kicking upwards, fists raised, tumbling backs, legs, pigtails, faces. Good Lord, he cried, horrified, and banged to the iron door upon this vision. This was what he had come on the bridge to tell. He could not keep it to himself, and on board ship there is only one man to whom it is worth while to unburden yourself. On his passage back the hands in the alleyway swore at him for a fool. Why didn't he bring that lamp? What the devil did the coolies matter to anybody? And when he came out, the extremity of the ship made what went on inside of her appear of little moment. At first he thought he had left the alleyway in the very moment of her sinking. The bridge ladders had been washed away, but an enormous sea filling the after deck floated him up. After that he had to lie on his stomach for some time, holding to a ring bolt, getting his breath now and then, and swallowing salt water. He struggled farther on his hands and knees, too frightened and distracted to turn back. In this way he reached the after part of the wheelhouse. In that comparatively sheltered spot he found the second mate. The boatswain was pleasantly surprised, his impression being that everybody on deck must have been washed away a long time ago. He asked eagerly where the captain was. The second mate was lying low, like a malignant little animal under a hedge. Captain? Gone overboard, after getting us into this mess. The mate who, for all he knew or cared. Another fool. Didn't matter. Everybody was going by and by. The boatswain crawled out again into the strength of the wind, not because he much expected to find anybody, he said, but just to get away from that man. He crawled out as outcasts go to face an inclement world. Hence his great joy at finding Jukes and the captain. But what was going on in the tween deck was to him a minor matter by that time. Besides, it was difficult to make yourself heard. But he managed to convey the idea that the Chinamen had broken adrift together with their boxes, and that he had come up on purpose to report this. As to the hands, they were all right. Then, appeased, he subsided on the deck in a sitting posture, hugging with his arms and legs the stand of the engine room telegraph and iron casting as thick as a post. When that went, why, he expected he would go to. He gave no more thought to the coolies. Captain McWhirr had made Jukes understand that he wanted him to go down below to see. What am I to do then, sir? And the trembling of his whole, wet body caused Jukes' voice to sound like bleeding. See first. Dot dot bus dot 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 says dot 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 adrift. That bus is a confounded fool, howled Jukes, shakily. The absurdity of the demand made upon him revolted Jukes. He was as unwilling to go, as if the moment he had left the deck the ship were sure to sink. I must know. Dot dot can't leave. Dot dot, they'll settle, sir. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.